This is episode 685 of the AWS podcast, released on September 16th, 2024.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the AWS podcast. Simon Alicia here with you, and I'm welcoming you to our new special series called Beyond the API. Now, these are occasional long-form episodes where I get to dive super deep with some of Amazon's distinguished engineers, creating the space to discuss the how and why, in addition to the what of the things that they do. Now, you may wonder, what is the role of a distinguished engineer? Well, Amazon distinguished engineers are individual contributors and technical leaders within the company who provide expertise and drive technological innovation. They're the ones who help establish the technical standards, they ensure infrastructure efficiency, optimize reliability, and scale operations. Distinguished engineers at Amazon also play a crucial role in AWS's security culture and broader engineering community initiatives, often holding titles that encompass additional executive responsibilities such as vice president. They go super deep, they work with some of the gnarliest problems, and they help scale through others. It's a really interesting role, it's fascinating, and hopefully we'll learn a lot about how they think about things. So sit back and let's take some time to look beyond the API. Hello everyone and welcome back to the AWS podcast. I'm joined by a very special guest today. I'm joined by Vice President and Distinguished Engineer and all-around interesting person, Colm McCarthy. How are you going, Colm?
Great. How are you?
I'm good. Welcome to the podcast. Now, this is the second of our special series of Beyond the API. And again, we're going to have an opportunity to explore some things with Colm about that he's worked on that many of our listeners, in fact, I'll guarantee that you have used something that Colm has worked on in some way, shape, or form. That's the weirdness here of operating at scale. But Colm, before we start, let's start with the fundamental question that is almost like the origin story of IT people. What was your first computer?
Oh, wow. The first computer I had, which also is my cunning way of aging you. Sure. The first computer I had at home that my parents got was a Commodore 64. And I remember having a lot of fun with it and reading the manual over and over and learning to program in BASIC on a Commodore 64 and learning its sprite system and a bunch of things. And even from that first computer, never really used it to play games, just like to make it do things, which was fun.
And that's it. And particularly with the Commodore 64, that was the gaming computer of its day because of the sprite system. It was like, you know, people wanted to have games, but you kept on the coding and the basic development side. What drove you to do that rather than game?
I don't know. I think it was, I mean, when you first power a Commodore 64 on, I don't know if many people listening will ever have done that, probably not, but you get this, you know, really primitive text screen, right? That's what you get if there's...
It's very blue.
...nothing else going on. Yeah, you get two shades of blue and you get a prompt. And even if you wanted to play a game, you know, for the most part, you actually have to tell the prompt to load the game, right? You know, and read it from a cassette and then you'd be able to play a game. So even like right away, it's telling you to like type things and it, you know, give it instructions. And, you know, it's just really obvious that, oh, there's more that you can do from there. You know, you can ask it to do other things than just load a game. And so to me, it just seemed like that's what it wanted you to do. You know, that's what its primary application was for. Although you're right, like Commodore 64 was a really great gaming computer for its day, based on what it could do. There were lots of popular games, you know, people could play with it. It was pretty affordable too. So
that's true. Yeah. That was the breakthrough. It was accessible. It was hard to break it as well. Like it was kind of like this nice sealed unit.
Yeah, they're pretty indestructible, which is good because they were given to a lot of young kids.
Teenagers and gentle don't go together.
You know, by the time my parents got one, they were pretty affordable. You know, they'd been made for quite a few years. I remember, you know, there were other kind of like basically a keyboard that you plug into a TV kind of computers at the time, like Amiga and Amstrad both had versions of that. Those were much more expensive. And you always got the sense that like, no, you had to be a really rich kid or something to get one of those. And that would probably be, you know, treated like a trophy in a cabinet case or something, you know, like you
don't touch the computer. Yeah,
exactly. But the Commodore 64, you could just, you know, tinker away at it. It was good fun.
So let's then spin all the way forward and talk to us a little bit about what you currently do at Amazon, because we're also going to explore some of the other things you've done. But what does today Colm do?
Today, my main job is actually helping build our European sovereign cloud in Europe. And I'm leading the technical side of that, making sure we build the region, get it running in time, but also, you know, solving everything it takes so that we'll be able to run that autonomously with only European residents as operators and so on. And working closely with several different regulators and customers and how that's going to meet all their compliance needs and so on. And there's a fair bit of engineering in there too, thankfully, which is, you know, to meet the right level of regulatory compliance, we need to be able to build systems that essentially guarantee, you know, we have no access to the customer's data. And, you know, that just helps solve a lot of compliance issues. The Nitro system is an example of a system we built like that from day one in EC2, but we're applying that same standard to some other services now, more and more. And some, you know, the code I write and review is now all on that kind of side of things, trying to build hermetic systems that are, you know, really well protected and sealed off. And it's fun.
Well, I think it's interesting if we think about the work that a distinguished engineer does, that often the elements are a lot of ambiguity, a lot of complexity, often high stakes, I think is a way you could term it. But it's interesting because what you're talking about here has that really interesting line between, you know, people and politics and regulatory requirements and that sort of interaction and technology, like there's code, there's bits together. What sort of mental models do you try and use to span those two? Because, yeah, certainly it's nice to just sit down in front of a terminal and just do your thing. But in this situation, you can't kind of do that, can you?
No. I mean, I think it's always been my experience that if you don't build something people can actually use or get the benefit from, it's not going to be as satisfying. You know, ultimately, you get a lot more gratification when you can see other people are on with something you've built and, you know, do their own creative things and build on top of that. And, you know, for a situation like this where customers have, you know, regulatory and compliance needs and we want to be able to make sure that they're solved as easily as possible, I find it useful to be able to go with them and go, well, just in plain terms, like the simplest you can possibly explain it, you know, what's your problem? What are your issues? And also, what are your opportunities? And break that down. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, turns out we already have solutions for everything people need. You know, like in my case, if they just need data to be in Europe, you know, that's our default if people are creating their data in the European region and so on. Or if they, you know, need to know how do we comply with GDPR or, you know, any of 100 other policies, those are all easy to cover. Those are all things we have. But when we, you know, in this context, the new things that we're trying to address are things like, you know, how would you make sure that this European cloud continues operation, you know, even if it had to be, you know, disconnected from the rest of the internet effectively, or if Europe for some reason cut off for some kind of geographic reason, you know, how would you deal with that? And that's a very very high level ambiguous thing. Like that's like a stratospheric level.
Yeah.
Well, how would that work?
But it also translates down to a bunch of like super detailed, nuanced little, like this is the, I think, the interesting part of the role is it, like, you're expected to be at like 50,000 feet and ground level and bounce between the two.
So you have to be able to turn down to, okay, well, that means there can't be any synchronous dependencies outside of the region. Anything asynchronous has to have very, very long tolerances. There has to be a lot of, you know, scrutiny on any potential, you know, data that leaves this cloud and so on. And everything has to be vetted to the nth degree and so on. And all of that boils down to technical work. A lot of it is, you know, classic security work, but some of it is, you know, cryptography engineering and other things like that. And so being able to span those distances is very useful. And it's I think helpful to have people around who can be in both worlds, like their feet on the ground and their head, you know, all the way in the cloud, so to speak, because otherwise it would take a committee and there would be a lot lost in translation and you'd have to go back and, you know, recheck a lot.
So having the right people around you is always an important thing to get things done.
Hopefully.
Now, you touched on crypto, so let's dive into crypto. Because, of course, the main rule of crypto for most of us is don't roll your own crypto. But you don't adhere to that rule.
No.
For a very good reason. Talk to me about S2N, because S2N I think is fascinating. Because firstly, that's probably one of the things that many people touch without knowing they touch, because it's in a whole bunch of stuff. But talk to us about S2N, your involvement in it, how you thought about that problem domain, because it came out of some pretty interesting challenges that I think the whole industry was having.
Yeah. So S2N is our open source library for doing the TLS and SSL protocols. These days we do QUIC as well, which are, you know, the most ubiquitous common encryption protocols. Every website you visit at this point, practically, every, you know, transaction you're making is almost certainly there's some TLS or SSL involved. And the S2N project was started, you know, I wrote the first few lines of code for that the day after the Heartbleed event, which was a pretty awful vulnerability in the open source OpenSSL library, which you know, the vulnerability could be remotely exploited, and you know, the entire internet was impacted by this. It was front page news on every newspaper.
it was horrible.
It was not a fun place to be. And I decided after seeing, you know, the code that was involved in that vulnerability, that it was just so avoidable as an issue, you know, if some better practices had been followed, that I just figured, if there's one, there's probably more issues like that. And there are probably going to be a lot of them over the next, you know, few years, because now a lot of researchers suddenly know there's probably, you know, rich pickings here. Let's
look
go
here.
Look. Exactly. So because of that, you know, if we just stayed on OpenSSL, we'd probably have to do a lot of updates and upgrades, and it would impact, you know, how quickly we could move and so on. So I figured, let's just write a hyper minimal replacement that's just paranoid, and you know, we'll prove it correct and start using that. And that's what we did. I started writing that, got it to the point where it could actually work on my own, and then worked with others internally to get it formally verified and vetted. And, you know, we started switching over AWS services to it, I think 8-9 years ago now.
Time's passed.
And now it's pretty widely used.
It is pretty pervasive. I think it's a great example of where you looked at a sort of large scale problem, and you reached for the keyboard, but you did it with a mental model of saying, well, if the problem here is complexity, and understand, I mean, you know, OpenSSL, great library, does a lot of stuff for a lot of people. People, you know, realize that they were relying on it for a whole lot of things, but it was trying to be all things to all people, and you can't. And I think if there's one thing we've learned is that simplicity is the thing you got to fight for, because there's sort of this entropy in systems driving to be more complex, more things. And this is a great opportunity to say, no, stop. We need a thing that just does this thing so that I can, you know, anyone can read it with a reasonable level of capability, can read it and understand it, and as you say, formally verify it. But that takes a bit of courage and a bit of pushiness to get that idea up, because that's, you know, sounds like a lot of work to do that.
Yeah. Well, I think that an appreciation for minimalism kind of I think becomes much more common in folks the more they've run anything and the greater, you know, a greater scale they encounter, pretty much everybody starts to appreciate. You really do want to make things as minimal as possible and as have a few ways to run it as possible and as few options and modes and all of that, because all of that complexity can backfire. And you don't tend to have to sell a lot of people on that once, you know, they work somewhere like AWS, you know, it's they kind of get that pretty implicitly. But it did take a fair bit of, you know, internal, convincing to, you know, make a strong case that, you know, we really want to, it really is worth doing this ourselves here and having strong first party ownership. You know, we're not going to, it's not, you know, our SSL and TLS implementation is not directly revenue generating, right? That isn't how it works. So it has to, you know, the work it will take to move to it, you know, had to really, really be worth it. You know, for us, that was a bit of showing, well, here's how much it costs us every time we have to do an update. And let's,
because there's a non-zero chance this will happen again at some point. So
yeah, so if we can save, you know, n of those, you know, it starts to become really clear pretty quickly that it just pays for itself in developer time. Now that math doesn't mean you suddenly have that number of developers or something at your disposal. Yeah. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
But it's that helps make a pretty strong case, and then, you know, writing it in a way where no matter who scrutinizes it or looks at it, they're going to kind of nod their head and go, yeah, this is really defensive. You know, this is built in a way that's hopefully very systematically resilient to issues and gives people a lot of confidence. I think those two things probably are what cut us over the line.
And I think that open sourcing of it as well helps for our customers to sort of also have that confidence to say, well, you know, yes, AWS is using this particular library, but hey, all of our security folks can look at it, understand it, tear it apart, that sort of stuff. I think the other interesting element of what you're talking about there that again, I think gets lost in a lot of companies over time is that you're vice president, you're very senior in the organization, but you wrote code. You still write code. And, you know, the catchphrase of the podcast is keep on building. And the reason why I say that is because I think it's the only way to remain relevant and understand what's possible beyond what you read. When you reach for that, I'm sure you didn't know what it was you were going to end up with, but you had amalgamated all these lessons and observations. And then also because you're always doing stuff in reality, this wasn't a PowerPoint presentation. This was you trying to actually see, or is this feasible, which changes the dimension of the conversation when you go speak to folks and say, well, I want to do this, and look, here's the minimum lovable product I created on the weekend. It changes the conversation, doesn't it?
It sure does. And I also, you know, it's the most fun I have at work, to be honest.
Amen.
You know, like if I can take some time, carve it off and just like write code and get something, I get enough of that time that I can build something relatively significant. That's incredibly satisfying, you know. That's its own reward right there.
Yeah.
And it is an important way to keep up and stay fresh and know, you know, where the industry is and all of that. It's also, I think, really important to have a sense of what our new developers are dealing with. You know, if someone's coming into AWS or Amazon from college, you know, I'd love to know, like, what's it like for them right now? How hard is it to get going and so on? That's a really important thing to not get too disconnected from, I think. Because if that gets bad, you know, a whole organization can slow down and you don't want that. So that's another reason why it's important. But yeah, it's got to keep those key skills going. But I mean, you'd expect the best surgeons to be regularly doing surgery, or the best musicians to like regularly be playing music. I mean,
that is an excellent analogy, but it's interesting. I think, certainly in my experience in technology, that we have this weird thing where senior technology folks get forced into kind of a leadership type role that, you know, their main operating system is Excel and the main language they use is PowerPoint. And you're right, it's you lose that relevance. So the question then is, okay, you've got this senior role, global remit, all that good stuff. How do you organize your time? How do you know, it's one thing to say, well, I really want to code and do sort of stuff, but got to go meet with the European Union folks. You know, how do you organize yourself? What's your, given that there's no right approach,
yeah.
How do you like to organize yourself?
Sure. I mean, you do have to be defensive and insist on budgeting time to an extent. And there's a bunch of tricks I've learned to keep things going. Because as you're saying, right, like as you rise in an organization, you will generally be asked to take on more work leading people or, you know, helping them figure out what to do or even administrative work and so on, right? And a lot of helping direct things at scale is like that, and rightly so. Like that's important work. But then that could become all of your time if you allowed it to, right? Because sure. Organizational work like that, the organization's always going to be so much bigger than you are. There are always going to be people who like want some of that time or would love help or whatever. So I found just calendar blocking to be essential. So I have literally just got massive blocks on my calendar of contiguous time, you know, like three hour blocks minimum, where I either use it to write a doc, because Amazon's a very document-oriented culture. That's just how we drive things.
How we roll.
Or to write code. And I have probably minimum of two of those a week that are there, like on my calendar. There'll be like at least somewhere in the week, there'll be two, like minimum 3 hour size blocks that are carved off. And I'll try to defend those. And then there, then probably another trick I do is for a big percentage of the meetings that I go to, I try to make sure that at least probably 60 to 70% of those meetings are the meeting where like I'm the most senior person, because it's like either my meeting and I'm leading it. And therefore, I'm either like reviewing something for folks or helping them or just like the sponsor of that thing and like need to make sure that it's happening and so on. And for those ones, I have this goal where after it's been up and running for a while, like those are typically recurring meetings, I shouldn't have to be there. Like I should be able to miss one or two, and the meeting should basically happen as if I were there, right? The people will know what to do. They'll know what to cover. Like it's got a bit of a routine to it. Yeah. And so when I'm starting those things out, I have that intention in mind that like my goal here in a few months is to be able to just not be here, one or two times in every few. And that really helps me, because then I can start using some of those slots for other things,
recycling
matters and so on. And then the rest of my calendar is things like customer meetings or something my boss put there, or like my boss's boss or whatever. And those I don't have as much freedom around. I just kind of have to go.
You're doing that.
And I really enjoy going to customer ones. Those are great.
Yeah.
Learn a lot that way. And I don't know. I just do it as best I can.
You make it, it's a choice. And it's interesting. I think the contiguous time is a really interesting insight, because anything related to writing, code development, anything creative, you've got to get into that flow, don't you? So it's not like you can say, well, I've got 30 minutes. I'm going to now work on this thing. It's like it's going to take you probably a good, well, you may be different, but a good hour to get up to speed and into that zone, and then it's all humming. You can't just page in and page out quickly.
Yeah, I think I find if I have 6 hours to write a doc, say, like a doc for a decision at Amazon, or 6 hours to write, some reasonably big unit of code, there's a very strong chance 5 of those hours I will not have been like writing something that I will ultimately keep or anything. And sometimes I will just be like sitting there with like writer's block, just kind of generally thinking about it. Eventually an outline comes to you, you know, you get past the first draft, you throw away that outline and, you know, start over again to an extent and you just iterate. And it ends up being like 90% of the actual production probably happened in, you know, 20% of the time.
Yep.
Like that's when you're actually just finally get into the flow state and get it out there. But if you don't have those first 4 to 5 hours of like wandering, the other super productive part just never happens.
Doesn't happen.
And I, you know, I feel it's hard not to feel a certain sense of like, you know, oh my God, I'm just being so unproductive, or I can't just bang this down.
Wasting time.
And I'm like, what am I doing? Or like, this is, you know, and I think only in the last few years have I really gotten comfortable with the fact that like, well, no, that's just how it is. And ultimately the output is fine.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's professions that don't work like that at all. Like I think like journalists and lawyers and so on, they have to be able to bang out writing that. Yeah, exactly. Just crazy. But like, doesn't work for me. I don't think I do well in those professions.
Well, this is why I think many, many great technology ideas happen when you're in the shower, because you're like, you're not connected to anything. You sort of got a bit of time and your mind is wandering like, aha.
Yeah, that's why we put whiteboards in the elevators.
Yeah, right? Yeah, I love that. Yeah,
sure. You never know.
Stuff happens when you don't expect it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from Dublin. I'm from Dublin in Ireland, and you know, very famously, William Rowan Hamilton invented quaternions. They just came to him on a walk by the canal, you know, miles from anywhere, and he scribbled them into the bridge, and you can. You know, people do that. They reenact that walk to this day, you know, and tell the story and so on.
Well, that was wasn't that the excuse he gave to the police when he got arrested for graffitiing the bridge? You don't know what I'm creating here.
Sure. Can't you see it's a quaternion? Yeah. Who knows?
Speaking of meetings, let's talk about one of my favorite meetings. I think a really interesting meeting that I know a lot of customers like to hear about. The operational metrics meetings. So, you know, the TLDR of this is, how do you make sure everyone's doing the right thing in a mechanistic way, not a good intention way? And how do we also teach others, et cetera? And this happens in this magical 3-hour meeting once a week, every Wednesday, I think it is. It could have changed the timing one.
Yeah, it's every Wednesday morning, Seattle time.
Because Thursday, my time. And anyone can watch these meetings within Amazon too, which is good. It's often a very entertaining thing to watch. But tell us, you've been involved for a long time. Tell us, you know, without divulging corporate secrets, et cetera, tell us a little bit about, you know, what the intention is, what the thought process is, what your role is in there, because you're an active contributor in that meeting. It's quite entertaining.
it is fun, yeah. So I joined AWS 16 years ago now, and the meeting just started a few months after I joined. So I was lucky enough that like I got to go to it from almost day one, and it started as, you know, hey, we've got a few services now, we should all get in a room once a week and review anything that's happened with those services operationally, whether that's an operational event like an outage or an issue, or just track their performance, you know, how's their latency doing, what are their call rates, like stuff like that. And like share with one another to get the benefits. And it was just convened as a meeting in a regularly sized conference room. And pretty quickly it got to the point where, wow, like this is a cool meeting. You learn a lot and people would come. And like, I would sit on the floor at that meeting, literally on the floor at the edges, because that's the only place that had space. And I would listen in and take notes. And as we grew and we grew and we grew, we just kept it as an open meeting. Like anybody could come was essentially the rule if you worked at AWS. And the format changed a bit over the years. Something we learned early on is, you know, when you're going to talk about operational issues and get into it, you know, you're naturally tending towards a negative, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So, but we actually don't suck. We actually are pretty good at what we do. And so we added a win section too. You know, let's actually start our meeting with like everything we did right. let's celebrate some great stuff. Success, that we did in the last week. And so now, and ever since, you know, we've always started with a bunch of wins where teams say, you know, here's what we did recently that, you know, really drove an operational improvement. And operational improvements could be things like, you know, lower the latency of a system or service, or drove an efficiency so that, you know, we've got savings we can ultimately pass on to customers, or made something much smaller, right? So that we can, or these days too, we celebrate how quickly we can build things for new regions and so on. So that those are really big wins that we'll share and celebrate. And then we get into, you know, any issues that happened recently, we'll cover them quickly, and we'll get into a very quick synopsis of what happened and why, making sure that we're in a position already that, you know, nothing like that could happen again. And then typically a week or 2 weeks later, that event will come back and we'll cover it in really thorough detail. Mm-hmm. So these teams, you know, we're writing up very detailed, what we call correction of errors, COEs, which are long write-ups, very detailed of what happened and why, and what all our action items are arising from it and what we're going to do, because we really want to make sure, you know, we never get repeat issues, and not just the issue, but like issues like that issue.
Yeah.
And then drive that. And then if we have time, you know, we cover metrics. So we'll do a dive into a service or two, and we'll go over their operational metrics deck that, you know, their on-call engineers would use, and just, you know, they'll walk us through it, and that lets us each calibrate, you know, what are good practices on metric decks, what are interesting metrics to pay attention to, how does this team think about its, you know, performance, and so on. And there's often a huge audience at these things. You know, thousands is not unheard of since we went virtual for the meeting. And and people share their insights and wisdoms, and it's and it can be pretty fun.
Well, there's a huge, you're right. It is fun. It can be robust, not in a harsh way, but you got to bring your A game to that meeting. Like there's some pretty smart folks in the room doing the thing. And it's interesting to me. I often enjoy the side channel, because there's a Slack channel alongside the operations metrics meeting where people are doing Slack messaging in there. And that whole, I mean, the conversations in there are like, there's probably university education just in some of those conversations.
Yeah.
When you got folks like Mark Booker and yourself and Becky arguing about how something should be done and discussing the different approach. I mean, there's so much that comes out of just that. That's the ancillary part of it. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I love this. The Slack channel is, I mean, people are using emoji reactions, you know, memes in there.
Yeah,
but there are like real lessons that people are drawing out. You know, there's much more airtime in the Slack channel than there is on the actual conference call. Mm. So you can have a bit of a more in-depth conversation there. And people draw out like really, you know, low level and nitty gritty lessons. And I've picked up some really, really valuable things just from reading the Slack. And then on the conference call itself, you're right, it can be robust, and it is, I mean, when it's intimidating to participate in a conference call almost any time.
Yeah,
it's obviously even much more intimidating when there could be hundreds or thousands of people on that call. You know, that just naturally, raises things a bit. And then, you know, you've got an audience of, you know, very senior folks who've been at Amazon a very long time, seeing everything. It can be a pretty direct culture, like in terms of like just get to it, not in an impolite way, but just, you know, we just want the data.
Yeah.
Yeah. We just want to get to it, but that can take a bit of adjustment. We're oddly not, we're not really a seniority culture. Like there's not, I have heard summer interns contribute to this meeting. I've heard engineers just out of college contributing to this, this meeting. And our senior most people in general won't treat them any different. You know, so it's got that edge to it too, which is I like.
Well, it becomes a cultural exemplar, because, you know, we're really trying to demonstrate that as a leader, and no matter how senior you are, you need to be connected to things. But also, you know, for as direct as it can be, there is this sort of sense of psychological safety in as much as it's okay to make a mistake. That's the whole thing about a COE. It's like, you know, things go wrong. Things will always go wrong. Thousands of things will go wrong. That's okay. Kind of what's not okay is to keep making the same mistake, not learning from the mistake. That's not okay. What we want to do is figure out things like, you know, how could we have detected this 50% faster? What do other teams need to be aware of? What lessons can we learn? What dogma can we create so we won't make the same mistakes over and over again? That's the stop hitting yourself model. And I think that's the value. And the directness, again, is just an efficiency to try and get to the root of the problem. And, you know, I think one of the greatest rules of question answering that we try and use is, you know, if a question is asked well, the answer is either yes, no, the data that was requested, or the time that you'll find the data and bring it back to me. And that's magical.
Yeah. And also just in the spirit of, you know, mistakes aren't punished in that sense. That's just not how things work.
No.
Like from the very first meeting I can remember, and before it had a name as a practice, like blame-free postmortems and so on, it was just utterly taboo for you to name or shame. Yeah. And if some poor engineer happened to be the person that typed in a command that like broke something or whatever, like, so what? That's not on them. Like,
it's on the system that let them do it. That's the thing.
But exactly. You know, I have worked places where that's not true, where the first question is who did this, like what's a, like blah blah blah, who's their boss, like all this kind of stuff, like, and that's the first line of question, which I think
because it's easy to throw a person under the bus than to say our systems suck and we have to do better and we're going to do a ton of work to make them better. It's a lot easier to say, well, we sacked that person so it can never happen again.
Yeah, but I from day one at those meetings at AWS, and also on every operational event or everything I've ever been on, I have never heard that kind of question or seen that kind of, you know, avenue of investigation pursued. Like, everyone just understood, like, well, that's not what we're here for. And it, like, that would just be silly. And, you know, and I think that's probably one of the most important aspects of the culture. I think that part of psychological safety is important. Both for sustainability, like just running a business, you couldn't run on fear. But also, I actually, you know, I think an operator who's not, like, nervous about that happening, so it's probably going to make more mistakes.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Exactly. Yeah, you're more just, timid. And
Yeah, it's just self-defeating. It's just like,
and we've all been there. It's that moment that you do something and you get that sort of creepy, warm, cold feeling at the back of your neck and you know you've done something wrong.
Oh, yeah.
And it's going to be really hard to fix. Like, and I feel a sense of empathy with anyone who has that, because we've been there. Like, and the worst thing, and you know, the thing to remember is they're going to beat themselves up way more than anyone else can beat themselves up. Like, you know, that's, they're already frustrated as hell.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's, I feel they're, I've had that reaction myself enough times.
It's like, you go back. It's not good. It's not good. Now let's talk about stressful situations. Let's talk about things that aren't so great, but have to be dealt with. And, you know, I was phone tool stalking. So on Amazon, we have these things called phone tools, which are kind of like recognition of different things you're a part of. Some of them are, you know, common, some of them are really unusual, et cetera. And some of them it just helps you when you look up someone to know where they've been, what they've done. Kind of like medals in the army, I think, in a way. But you've got a lot of phone tools, so I'm not going through all the phone tools. But one of them that leapt out was the Call Leader phone tool. And you've got many years service, including Prime Day and holiday peaks as well. But this is for the Call Leader program. What does a Call Leader do? What's involved in that kind of thing? And how do you like to tackle, how do you think about that problem? Because this is a crucible moment of leadership when stuff's going bad.
Yeah. Well, the Call Leader Program has been around a very, very long time. And it's an on-call rotation of generally very tenured folks who've been at Amazon quite a while and know their way around, know a lot of the systems, the people. And then this rotation, it handles if we have a large operational event. So if something's impacting, you know, multiple AWS services or anything that you'd categorize as, you know, large or
significant,
or has the potential to become large or significant. Yeah. So we also handle not events. that you know, we made sure they were non events,
which we like. They're the best ones.
that's good. And there's a few other things too. Like on Prime Day, you know, we have some specific processes running proactively, even if there's no event at all. Right, we're just keeping a very close eye on things. And if there is an event, you know, that is led and coordinated by the call leaders. You know, I've seen other companies call these folks incident commanders, but we say call leader. And it's that person's job to, you know, drive it to resolution and then make sure it doesn't happen again. And it's a lot of, you know, helping people through a stressful situation they've probably never encountered before, trying to get, you know, clarity in the midst of that event and make sure we're doing the right things to mitigate it as quickly as possible. And it's a really, I find, a very rewarding way to contribute too, because, you know, you're able to use a lot of your knowledge in real time to affect a better outcome for everybody involved, also in real time. And I think the call leader program also, you know, has been shown over and over again to really speed up and shorten the length and duration of potential events. So it's absolutely worth having.
It's worth having, but it's a skill, isn't it? I mean, it's something that you need to work on, because you're being asked to firstly create a sense of calm for those around you. You're the focal point of coordination. So you've got lots of inputs coming out. You're trying to generate outputs. You're trying to prioritize and decide, etc. You kind of got to bring a certain persona to that table to do that.
Yeah, I think there are people that may not suit, and there are people that might suit more than others. But it is a skill that you do get better at over time, and practice works for. Calm is probably one of those key skills. You know, first piece of advice we tell call leaders and anyone who joins an operational event is stay calm. You know, clear heads will win the day. Yeah. And, you know, a frenetic energy or a very high pitch energy, they don't help. They will generally slow things down. And even though an event is very serious, that doesn't mean you respond like that. And, you know, it's the same in all sorts of situations, right? If you go into an emergency room and they're dealing with, you know, somebody who's coded or whatever, it's generally not like on television, right?
No.
It's not like Eeyore, right? The TV series. They're pretty calm and they're just going through it methodically. And that ultimately is what will be best. And so just helping people achieve that calm and focus, you know, giving people regular summaries and, you know, reminding them there's some sense of control and purpose in the midst of all this can really help. Yeah. Focusing people on mitigating things also really helps. Asking people the right questions, all of those things just help center people. Also, just reminding people that, you know, never mind Dave West, like almost the entire industry basically has 100% track record of restoring service from every event that's ever occurred, which is amazing, right? It's not like civil engineering or aviation automotive where like there's lots of write-offs, like there's lots of, you know, things that systems never come back from. But that's not true in our industry. In our industry, you know,
we can rebuild.
Absolutely. We'll get it back. And as quickly and as reliably as possible is the key.
True. Let's talk creativity again. Another phone tool is the Patent Award phone tool. And you have the over 50 patents Patent Award phone tool, which is pretty impressive and amazing. But let me start with a difficult question. I'm going to ask, you know, which is your favorite child? What is your favorite patent? What's the one?
Oh,
and
that's
not to be, you know, but what's the one that you're like, yeah, I'm pretty proud of that one. That was a good idea, you know?
I honestly forget them basically as quickly as they're issued.
To be fair, it does take years to get your patent through the process.
Yeah, you submit them. Like you submit them and then like years later, you find out it was issued. And then you get this nice email reminding you and you go, oh, okay.
Puzzle piece.
That's That's pretty cool. I think my very I remember my very first one, which was one actually around how to do video segmentation and to get better caching efficiencies for streaming video and in some non-obvious ways. And that was a fun one. And I was proud of getting that one issued. But more proud of the fact that we actually used it, used that technique. And that was fun. Every service I've worked on, you know, we just had these regular meetings where we sit down and we go, well, let's work with the legal team and make sure we go through everything we're innovating. And the legal team will help us, then, you know, translate that into, patent submissions and so on. But like I said, because of the years thing, you kind of forget pretty quickly.
You forget. What I get. Yeah. I did something a while back. It was obviously okay. Yeah. So tell us currently, what do you reach for from a technology standpoint? Like if you have an idea and you want to test it out, what are you reaching for? What's your workflow like? What's your technology piece like? No judgment, but just interested to know what.
Yeah. It's going to sound cliched for the moment, but I am spending every day. I have the Bedrock console tab open and I am playing with Bedrock. and I think it's pretty cool what you can do in there. And I try the same thing with like three or four different models and see what the differences are and try to kind of interpret what that means for how those systems were built and so on, just for my own kind of education. And then I use it like as an actual tool that way too. And I'll be like, I have this C library that I wrote a long, long time ago, over 25 years ago. And I'm trying to translate it to Rust without writing a line of Rust code.
Nice.
So I'm seeing like, how can I break it down and how can I get this tool to do it for me? Because I actually think that's more interesting. And it's challenging for it because like these LLMs and so on are pretty good at solving things they've seen before out there in the corpuses and so on. But this is a really obscure library. Like there's no, so it's struggling with it. And finding ways to help it understand more of what's going on, I find really interesting. Because then I'm asking myself, well, then, but how can I generate that extra understanding so that these systems...
Yeah, how can I nudge it in the right place?
Yeah. So that's the kind of thing I'm doing right now.
So is Rust your language of choice at the moment, would you say? Or where do you sit in terms of language?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've always worked on low-level systems, you know, writing machine code in C generally for, you know, high performance networking, cryptography, and systems-y things. Those classically always been C. But in the last 5 years or so, we've been, nope, you should be doing that in Rust now, you know. And so pretty much everything new we do is in Rust. And there's a lot of taking some older stuff and Rustifying it. So yeah, trying to become more and more conversant in Rust. It's probably my default language now.
Nice. Now let's talk a bit about security and let's talk a bit about designing for security and again, mental models and thought processes around that. You were very involved in Nitro Enclaves and the creation of that. And maybe let's start with the thought philosophy behind that technology and then some of the technology decisions you had to make and the team had to make it do the thing we wanted to do, because it's kind of this weird don't let anyone touch stuff type model, but stuff has to still be touched. How do we figure that out? So start at the start, like Nitro Enclaves, what is it? Why do we have it?
So right at the beginning of this conversation, we talked a bit about European Sovereign Cloud and how, you know, customers want to have peace of mind that only they have access to their data. Right. They don't want their cloud provider to be able to access their data. When we built the EC2 Nitro system, we took that as a strong requirement from day one. We're going to build this system in a way where, you know, we already have other systems and policies and, you know, lots of mechanisms that ensure, you know, not, like no one at AWS can just go access customer data. That's not a, couldn't, it would take me hours to describe all of the amounts of protection that are in the way of that. But there's something a little bit even stronger again about a system like Nitro where, no, it's just impossible. Like the system does not
The capability to access that was not built into the system. Like that's the ultimate protection, isn't it?
Like, yeah, exactly. Like this, exactly. It's just not even there. Like it doesn't, it just doesn't have that address space. Like it just, like it's just not even there. So a lot of the other traditional protections, you don't even need them because like the system's like it's.
Because you're not protecting it. There's nothing to protect.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Right. And so with Nitro Enclaves, our goal was, you know, wouldn't it be great for customers to be able to do this as well for themselves, right? So customers often have sensitive workloads and data sets, you know, like maybe their customers or end users' health information or advertising data is another one where, you know, there's a lot of privacy-sensitive information in there and so on. And so, you know, we have customers who'd love to be able to do some processing on that information, but don't want to have access to the information themselves, right? So we built Nitro Enclaves as a tool for them where, you know, they can encrypt those data sets, and those data sets can only be decrypted, you know, provably inside the Nitro Enclave. And the Nitro Enclave is, you know, super hermetic. It's got no network access. Mm-hmm. It's got, you know, it's an isolated virtual machine. It's like, basically, think of it like a virtual server that you just get a serial cable into it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, very, 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 very isolated. So you can do all sorts of processing in that safe environment and then only send out the results that have been sanitized or safe to reveal, you know, and just make that as integrated and as easy as possible for customers. And so we, you know, our take on that was Nitro Enclaves. And today we've got a lot of customers building on top of that. You know, there are other ways to do it. And we support some of those other ways too. You know, there are other confidential computing techniques where you can use CPU style enclaves and so on. But our take there was, those are just too hard to use. Like they're just asking the customer to do too much. You know, by the time they're having to think about memory transactions and CPU instruction fencing, you're really constraining how many people could build on that, you know, whereas we just wanted to be like, here's a virtual machine, run any operating system you like, but it will be in a very hermetic, sealed off environment. And, but we'll give you the primitives you need, including, you know, KMS integration so that you can just encrypt data in and out very easily. And, you know, we've seen customers build on top of that model much more quickly. Like we've gone to them and, you know, within a day or two, they're able to have a model
able to get going. Yeah, that's a much lower bar of entry to get the right thing happening.
Yeah, and it's becoming more and more important too because we're taking the same model and working with NVIDIA and others on applying this for AI environments too because, you know, customers are telling us, you know, I spent a lot of money training this model. I need to make sure it's very well protected. And so can we run that inside, you know, a very hermetic, you know, enclave-like environment? And so that's something we announced we're working on as well.
Oh, it's a very interesting space. Now let's pivot to yourself, Colm. You are yet another technology person who also has a deep interest and capability in music. It seems to be, and in fact, there's some ivories being tinkled in the background right now. Like there's clearly a musical bent that ties into a lot of IT folks. Tell us about your music and your interest in that area.
Yeah, I played music since a pretty young age. I grew up in Ireland where music is very common. And, you know, at school, most kids learn instruments, and I learned, you know, fiddle from when I was pretty young, and then I started taking up other instruments, mostly playing traditional Irish music, which is not that common in other places. just stuck with it, picked up instrument after instrument, and have a nice collection now, and play a bunch of different things. Still tour and record occasionally, but nowhere near what I used to.
Do you think it connects into the way you look at IT problems? Is there a similarity there, or is this a complete escape for you in terms of the way your brain is working on the in the situation?
For me, it's very different. You know, for me, playing music is much more visceral, and you know, when I'm teaching people how to play guitar or guitar accompaniment, especially, you know, I'm focusing on how to move your body, how to, you know, really like sway with a rhythm and develop a groove, or how to like, you know, pay attention to very small moments, or how to practice things. And none of that, you know, just real visceral kind of human part of things comes up quite as much in our work. There are other things too that do. I mean, like listening first, you know, really trying to seek understanding and so on before making your own contributions. I think those kinds of things still apply. But I find the approach very different, especially because, you know, you can't be data-driven when it comes to music.
No. You know, it's like the opposite. It's all the feels.
You have to feel it. And that's very different.
So tell me, which technology person of any time would you most like to meet and why?
Oh, man.
I'm not even asking easy questions, Colin. This is like the operation review, you know? Not here for easy questions.
I think Von Neumann would probably be super interesting, and you could, you know, you could cover an unbelievable amount of ground with that guy, right? You could be talking about the Manhattan Project 1 minute, and the next minute talking about like, you know, incredibly deep, you know, computational theory or something like that. And he also just encountered a lot of interesting people.
Well, that's true, isn't it? Yeah, so who he met as well.
So that would definitely be interesting.
And, you know, a lot of our listeners will be familiar with your name, your voice, your appearance, because they've seen you at reInvent or Reinforce or many. I mean, you're a prolific presenter. You take a quite a different approach to a lot of corporate presentations, which I appreciate. And I wanted to ask you how you prepare the presentations that you do, because you're often covering some pretty big ground in some of the things you talk about. What's your approach? What's your style?
Yeah. Well, once again, there's a lot of wandering and not producing anything for quite a while until, you know, you do most of the work in the last, you know, quarter of the time remaining or whatever. My goal is that someone who's barely conversant in the industry should still be able to get a lot of value out of it, no matter what depth you're going to talk about, right? And so I always have, you know, in my mind, like maybe undergraduate who is struggling in their class is you still want to be able to reach that person, right? And then the next thing I work on is it should somewhat have a story. There should be a beginning, middle, and an end, and there should be some kind of natural progression to it. And that it is more important to keep people in the flow than anything else, right? To have the right connective tissue between each slide or each little piece of story and the you know, the previous and the next one, so that you can maintain that sense of flow. And if you don't have that sense of flow, start over and, you know, redo that part and compromise on a lot of other things just for the sake of that flow. And I do that when I'm writing docs too.
Do you think that ties into then, you talked about musical performance and the feeling of it and what it's conveying. Is this like a melding of those two concepts together in a way?
Yes. So if I am accompanying a piece of music, it will also have a flow, and I will be very intentional about, you know, do we start loudly and where do we set back from that? You know, where do we change the dynamics, or do we start softly and ramp up and then ramp down and all of those? And they have to match the right mood, but to be intentional about it and not just like it's an accident where those things happen.
So it's not jazz.
Well, I mean, jazz can have that too, right? But it's usually a collective story.
True. And Colm, a couple of last questions before we wind up today. What's your IDE of choice at the moment? What's your tooling look like? What do you like to draw?
Oh, well, it's not really at the moment, but it's Vim, which I've used, since the 90s.
Forever.
And except when I'm writing Java, which isn't that often, but it's sometimes it's some teams at Amazon, I've written Java for serious periods of time. And use whatever IDE that Java people tell me is the current best IDE for Java, which for a long time was Eclipse.
Yes.
But is no longer. And apart from that, I'm almost always just in Vim.
How many key bindings do you have?
Not that many.
Really?
So I have my dot files are in a repo on GitHub. Anyone go look at them. There's really very, very little in there. And I used to be a system administrator. You know, I was that for 10 years before joining AWS. And I just logged into so many fresh systems that weren't customized. Mm. Like, it was just so important to me to be proficient in, like, the absolute defaults that I've just never... I basically never customize my local environment for stuff like that. And, you could steal my laptop and I'll just get another one and be productive in about an hour. I just don't do it.
It's interesting. I wonder if that's a generational thing to some extent. Cause I remember when I was studying at uni back in the day, I remember very clearly a lecturer saying to us, make sure you learn Vi. Because that will be the thing that's always available on any system you're on. And there's going to be some time you're going to be really in it and you're going to need an editor and it's there. And I've always stuck by, like, to the same point, like, Vi is always there and I know how to drive that sucker and I can do what I need to do. And it's probably the least efficient way to do stuff, but it's probably the most effective when you've got to get something done.
Yeah, same. And that's what steered me away from Emacs, because I'm sure Emacs is better.
Yeah.
Like, it's... but it won't be there. And,
so the thing you have is better than the thing you don't have.
Exactly. And so, I've just memorized so many different keystroke shortcuts and things that are just defaults. And really the only thing that's in my dot files for Vim, even, like, I don't have macros or extra shortcuts.
Wow.
And it's really just, I changed the default colors because, and my eyesight's not as good as it was.
Yep. font size.
So I'll increase font sizes and make things more legible. But that's about it. Like, everything else is just the way it comes out of the box. And I've never really, I'm the same with guitars. I'll put a lot of effort into making sure I get a good guitar, but I don't twiddle with it after that. And, if I'm in a show, is whenever I can borrow guitars or trade guitars, it often happens.
Because you're not expecting the ergonomics that you become reliant on to be there. Yeah.
Yeah. I've just never found, I'm just not the kind of person who spends too much effort on their own tools.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. And the final traditional question is, of course, tabs or spaces?
Oh my, spaces. I mean, come on.
All day, every day.
Sure. I'm a space cadet.
I have to ask because I'm going to find someone. I'm going to find someone at some point who can make a convincing argument, but we shall see.
Yeah. I mean, that's why we have formatting tools, right? That's the real answer.
This is true. This is very true.
It's the only way to solve a problem like that.
Hey, Colm, thanks so much for joining us today and sharing a little bit about your own journey and your own experience. It's been fantastic.
Thank you.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. We do love to get your feedback. AWS podcast at amazon.com is the place to do it. And until next time, keep on building.